Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. And today's discourse will be on the 13th sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta, the greater or longer discourse on the mass of suffering, the accumulation of suffering. And the reason why this is called the greater discourse is because in the Majjhima Nikaya, one finds very often paired suttas dealing with this common theme. One is longer than the other. The longer one is called the Maha Sutta, the greater or longer sutta. The shorter one is called the Chula Sutta, the short sutta. And so we have two suttas on the mass of suffering, and this is the longer one. Now, before I enter into a discussion of the sutta itself, I want to go back to an idea that I had introduced before we took up the suttas in the previous section of this course. Those were the suttas dealing with the ethical life. And when I introduced that area, I mentioned that the Buddha's teaching is directed to the achievement of three types of benefit, or three types of good. Okay, the first of these is the good pertaining to this life. These will be teachings dealing with basic ethics as a way of promoting harmony and cooperation amongst people. The teachings which explain the duties of people in different social positions in relation to their peers. Teachings, advice to rulers on how to administer the state. Teachings on people on how to live together peacefully in society. Teachings even to businessmen on how to succeed in their business by leading an ethical working life, and so on. The second benefit to which the Buddha's teaching is directed is the benefit pertaining to to future lives. And these will be the discourses dealing with the doctrine of karma and its fruits. Basically, the code of practice in the first and the second teachings is the same: observance of the five precepts, following the 10 courses of wholesome karma. But there's a difference in emphasis or in the purpose for which these are undertaken. And in the second level, one undertakes these practices with the view to acquiring good karma, meritorious karma, which will produce beneficial results for oneself in future lives, bringing a happy rebirth, success in one's undertaking, long lifespan, beauty, wealth, power, influence, long life, freedom from illness, and so forth. But the Buddha's teaching doesn't end merely with explanations of the way of practice directed to a happy future life. Since the Buddha's teaching is directed to a still higher or ultimate goal, and that is the attainment of vimukti, or liberation from the entire cycle of rebirths. Because as long as we remain within the cycle of rebirths, within the sphere of conditioned existence, we have to undergo again and again the suffering of birth, old age, illness, and death. And so the Buddha's higher teaching, the teaching which is special and unique to the enlightened ones, is the teaching of the path that leads to final liberation. And this path has to begin on the basis of the teachings that are relevant to the good here and now and the good pertaining to the future life. That is, unless one is engaged in the observance of fundamental ethical principles, only if one is leading a morally upright life can one undertake the practice of the path to final liberation. But the path to final liberation will involve practices which do not pertain to the good of the present life or of future lives, practices which are designed especially to cultivate insight or wisdom into the true nature of existence, the true nature of the world. And so to effect the transition from the good concerned with the present life and in future lives to concern with the ultimate good, the good of liberation, one requires a change, what you might call a quantum leap in changing one's perspective, acquiring a different and new perspective on the nature of the world. And the teachings that we will be taking, or the discourses we will be taking up in the present section of our Majjhima Nikaya course, section 4 on my original outline, these are discourses in which the Buddha, from different angles, exposes the unsatisfactory nature, the inadequacy, or the unsatisfactoriness, the inadequacy, the misery tied up with mundane, conditioned existence. And it is by gaining insight into the flawed, inadequate, unsatisfactory nature of worldly existence that one nurtures within oneself, that one arouses within oneself this impulse or yearning for deliverance, what's called the thought or intention of nekama, of renunciation, of the urge for release, for deliverance. And it is by contemplating again and again the flawed, unsatisfactory nature of worldly existence that this urge for liberation becomes strengthened, fortified, empowered to the extent that it can effect and accomplish the work necessary to attain true liberation from suffering. Okay, so now we can turn to the sutta itself and see what it has to teach us. Does everybody have a copy of the outline? Okay, this sutta begins, as so many do, when the Buddha was living at his favorite residence, the Jetas Grove in Savatthi. And then one morning, a number of monks, after dressing, they took their robes and bowl and they went into Savatthi, as they usually do, on their alms round. But it seems this morning they had gone in, they had entered somewhat early, and so they thought that people had not yet completed preparing their food. And so they decided to go to a park, which was a kind of hangout for wandering ascetics. In countries like America, Europe, parks are places where people go for recreation, where they have playgrounds for children to play. But in ancient India, perhaps even in present-day India in some parts, Parks were created as places for wandering ascetics to stop and reside while they were on their travels throughout the roads, the byways and highways of India. And wanderers, ascetics from different allegiances, different spiritual followings would meet in these parks. Some would find quiet resorts for meditation. Others would meet and hold discussions, which often would flare up into intense debates. And in this way, there was a constant exchange of ideas, circulation of ideas amongst the wanderers from all of the different schools of thought. And so the Buddhist monks now decide to engage in some interesting discussion. And so they come to this park where the wanderers from various sects are staying temporarily. And so after they exchange greetings with them, then the wanderers present the monks with a challenge. Okay, and there are some important terms here. First, I will read the passage, then I will discuss these important terms. Friends, the recluse or the ascetic Gotama describes the full understanding of sensual pleasures, and we do so too. The recluse Gotama describes the full understanding of material form or the body, and so do we. The recluse Gotama describes the full understanding of feeling, and we do so too. So they're asking, what is the distinction? What is the variance? What is the difference between his teaching of the Dhamma and our teaching? Between his instructions and ours? In other words, they think that they are teaching exactly the same thing that the Buddha does, and so they think that they will be on the same level as the Buddha, that their teaching will be just as effective a vehicle of liberation as the Buddha's teaching. And so these bhikkhus were probably not yet very deeply learned in the Dhamma, and so they decided not to either agree with the wanderers or to reply to this challenge and try to refute them, but instead, without either approving or rejecting the thesis of the wanderers, they got up, and then after going on their arms round and taking their meal, they decided to come. Well, they decided that after they had their meal, they would go to the Buddha and ask him to explain the differences. Okay, now the key word here, the most important word in this paragraph 3, is the word full understanding, which in Pali is the word parinya. Parinya. So the word parinya comes from the root nya, which means to know, from which we get the verb janati. And pari, the prefix pari, has the sense of fullness or completeness. So what's intended here is a full knowledge, complete understanding. And this is a very loaded term, in a sense, Buddhistically, because when the Buddha explained in his first discourse the Four Noble Truths, he said that the task that has to be fulfilled regarding the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering, is to fully understand this noble truth of suffering. And on numerous occasions, when the Buddha or the monks were asked, what is the purpose for which the spiritual life is lived under the Buddha said, it is for the purpose of full understanding, parinya. And interestingly, the commentary in its gloss on the word parinya says that it also has the implication of abandoning, eradicating, or overcoming. And interestingly, some years ago I saw also in some scholarly paper which showed that in Jain literature the word parinya was used in a similar sense of abandoning or overcoming. And then the statement in the text here points to three major areas in which this full understanding, this function of full understanding, has to be exercised. These areas are first kama, which means sensual pleasures. The second is rupa, which means physical form, material form, but more specifically the form of the body, bodily form. And then the third area is feeling. And if one reflects a little, one will see that these are three major areas with three major anchorage points, anchors, which keep us bound to the world. One is the quest for the enjoyment of sensual pleasures, sensual desire. The other is the attachment to our own bodies and to the bodies of others. Attachment to our own body, specifically through both craving and sometimes conceit. Attachment to the bodies of others, primarily through sensual desire, sensual lust, but also the sense of possessiveness. And then attachment to feeling, mainly through the craving, the relishing or enjoyment of present pleasure, and craving for continuation of pleasure. And so to wear away these attachments and propel the mind in the direction of liberation, one has to gain a kind of penetrative understanding and insight into the inadequate, unsatisfactory, flawed nature of sense pleasures, bodily form, and feeling. And it seems that many of the ascetic groups in the time of the Buddha, especially those which whose practice included some kind of meditative or contemplative discipline, had recognized the unsatisfactory nature of sensuality, bodily existence, perhaps even of feeling. And so there was a shared understanding that liberation, final liberation, is to be achieved through overcoming the attachments to sensuality, body, and feeling. But there was disagreement over what type of understanding is required to overcome these attachments. And since the wanderers didn't really understand the Buddha's teaching, they thought that they were on the same level as the Buddha. What is probably true is that the wanderers, or at least some of the wanderers who were more accomplished in meditation, had been able to achieve some of the higher meditative absorptions, the deep stages of samadhi or concentration, in which the mind withdraws from its fascination with sensual pleasures, in which the mind becomes detached from bodily existence, becomes absorbed in deep peace and equanimity. And because they were able to achieve these very pure and lofty meditative states, they thought that they had achieved full understanding of sensual pleasures, body, and feeling. But from the Buddha standpoint, they had really just stopped at a halfway house. without even gaining even a glimmer of deep understanding into the real nature of these things. All I had succeeded in doing was achieving some temporary respite, some temporary relief from the craving and grasping tied up with pleasures, body, and feeling. But the purpose of the Buddha's teaching is to show the way to complete liberation from these focal points of attachment. Okay, so now we continue with the discourse. Okay, so when the monks come to the Buddha and they report to him their discussion, the Buddha says, when the wanderers of other sects speak thus, they should be questioned thus. In other words, you should question them in return. Ask them, what is the gratification? What is the danger? What is the escape in the case of sensual pleasures, in the case of bodily form, material form, in the case of feelings? Being questioned thus, these wanderers will not be able to give a satisfactory explanation, and they'll get into difficulties if they try. And what is the reason for that? Because it is not within their domain. Then the Buddha says, I see no one in this world with its gods, with its Mara or demons, with its Brahmas or high divinities, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, who could satisfy the mind with a reply to these questions, except for the Tathagata, Rulai. Okay, good. I see her head shaking. Or a disciple of the Tathagata, the Thus Come One, or one who has learned the answer from them. And with this statement, the Buddha sketches or delineates three perspectives from which one can look at any conditioned phenomena. And this set of three terms is extremely important because it runs through the Buddha's teaching from, almost say, from beginning to end. We find particularly in the Sangyutta Nikaya so many suttas where the Buddha explains different types of phenomena, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the 18 elements, the different types of faculties, different types of feelings. And again he says that these should be understood from the standpoint of their gratification, the danger, and the escape from them. The word translated gratification, asada, I think it means the literally sweet taste, the sweetness, that is the enjoyment that these things offer. Then the adinava is, to say, the flawed nature, the drawback or the pitfalls within these objects of attachment. Then the sarana means literally it's the going out, flowing out from them. We translate escape, but this doesn't imply escapism, as though one is running away from something because one is afraid of it. But it's when you understand deeply and accurately the real nature of something which is flawed that one seeks release from it, the way out from it. It's as if one were in a burning building, burning house, and there were many enchanting toys in the house, maybe nice video players, video cassettes, nice furniture, a lot of food and drinks and charming people, and you're enjoying yourself, this will be the asada, the gratification in the house. But then if you look around out the window and you see that the upper story is on flames and the flames are spreading down, 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 until it's threatening, the ceiling is threatening to collapse and to kill yourself and all the people in the house, then you gain some glimpse of the adinava, the danger in the house. And then if a person who sees this danger goes looking for the fire exit, the way to get out of the house, that is seeking the nisarana, the escape. And so the Buddha uses these three perspectives as a way to diagnose all conditioned phenomena, to diagnose the nature of the world. And here he applies the scheme to these three focal points of attachment, beginning with sensual pleasures. And so we now take paragraph 7. Okay, what is the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures? Okay, there are these five, we call them cords of sensual pleasure. The Pali word kama guna. Guna doesn't literally mean cord, but qualities. So there are five sensually enticing qualities. And what are these five? There are visible forms cognizable by the eye that we wish for, that we desire. We find them agreeable and likable. They stimulate our sensual desire and provoke lust. Then there are sounds cognizable by the ear, smells, tastes or flavors, tactile sensations, cognizable by the body, also desired, wish for, desired, and so on. So these are five objects of sensual desire. So they're called the five cords of sensual desire. And based upon these five objects of sensual pleasure, when one indulges them, when one enjoys them, when one acquires them, enjoys them, indulges one's desire for them, there arise pleasure and joy. And this pleasure and joy that spring up based upon the five objects of sensual pleasure, this is called the gratification, the sweet taste, the enjoyment in sensual pleasures. And if there was only enjoyment in sensual pleasures, the Buddha would probably say, go get them, as many as you can, in as great as diversity as you can, and try to get them life after life after life. Even in the heavenly worlds, the sensual pleasures are supposed to be much more refined, much more intense than those in the human world. But the Buddha, through his enlightenment, has seen into the nature of sensuality. And so he also points out now the danger or unsatisfactoriness with regard to sensual pleasures. And this is quite long exposition, which gives the title to the sutta, The Great Mass of Suffering. First, I've given short characterizations to these types of danger. First, I call this the danger in acquisition, that in order to acquire objects of sensual enjoyment, one has to struggle and strive. The Buddha gives a description of a young man of his own time having to earn his living at some job, like Here he mentions crafts that were skills that were used in his time. I guess now we would say accounting, bookkeeping, clerical work, or else he could be working as a farm, cultivating vegetables, engaging in trade, cultivating animals, or else he could be employed as an archer in the king's service, or as an archer in the army, or working in some job in the government service, or any other craft. And in those days, living conditions were quite difficult, so in order to fulfill his work responsibilities, this young man will have to face, here they're relatively simple, cold and heat, contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things. He risks death by hunger and thirst. If he's employed, say, by a merchant to go on trading trips, he might have to cross deserts, go through jungles, and be exposed to constant dangers. Today, living conditions have changed somewhat, but think about people have to earn their living by traveling. Some people travel 2 hours to go to work. They have to drive 2 hours from their house to their job. Another 2 hours to come back, 4 hours a day, 1/6 of the day, sitting in a car behind a wheel, just doing, looking to the left and right, constantly concerned about traffic. And sometimes they might have to work 7-8 hours a day at a boring, uninteresting job, just to earn enough money to come back and support their family. I hear of people who, living in Long Island, they get up, they leave the house 7 a.m. to take the train into Manhattan to start work 8:30, 9 a.m., work until 5 p.m. Sometimes the boss demands that they work overtime, another 2 hours till 7 p.m. Then they get home at 9 p.m., just enough time to talk to their family a little, grab a bite to eat, go to sleep, and wake up the next morning at 6 a.m. in order to go to work at 7 a.m. And then when they're at work, the boss is always constantly demanding more, 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 putting more pressure on them. Can you work Saturday? We need you Saturday. And then sometimes they're sent on plane trips, frequent plane trips, that drains the energy of the body. And then people working at lower jobs, lower grade jobs, very boring, maybe in factory, having to fill. When I was a college student, I spent one summer working in a factory, a screw factory. Just I see how people work. All they do is fill the box with screws, put the cover over the box, and paste a label on it. 8 hours a day doing that. I did it only for 2 months, but these are people who are spending their lives doing that. So just to have a little money to support a family and to enjoy on the weekend, maybe to go to a tavern to drink with friends or to see a movie picture or listen to some music, to go dancing maybe. So that's the life. And this is fairly comfortable in America, but in more backward societies, so-called backward societies, people have to work. Well, even in the agricultural sector, people have to work, struggling day after day, cultivating the crops, dependent upon the climate, the weather. If there's a drought, a flood, then the whole livelihood is wiped out just within weeks or months. Okay, so now we have our young man working very hard to earn his money to enjoy some sense pleasures. Okay, but if he's working very hard, now we come to paragraph 9, and he doesn't really get enough earnings to enjoy himself, maybe to buy his own house, buy his own car, to take a wife and to marry, but he, maybe he comes to the big city thinking he's going to hit it, strike it rich, and instead he's renting a room in a slum area, just struggling to keep himself going day after day, just enough food to keep the body alive. This is the way so many people, billions of people in the world live, just earning enough to keep themselves alive, no real excess wealth to enjoy themselves. Then he becomes full of frustration and disappointment and grief, even to the point where he weeps, beating his breast, and thinks, oh, my work is in vain, my effort is fruitless. I've just wasted my life on this pointless labor. So that also is a danger in sensual pleasures. But if he should be one of those very diligent, industrious people who succeeds, he invests here, invests there, and maybe through some meritorious karma, he strikes it rich, he gets a lot of wealth, he can buy himself a nice mansion, nice two Mercedes, maybe, well, he doesn't want two Mercedes, a Mercedes and a Jaguar. Big television set, he can marry a beautiful girl and send his children to a nice good college. But constantly he has to worry, how can I prevent, what if thieves become attracted to my house? So he has to set up a security alarm system around the house. And he's worried that, in these days we don't have kings, but he's always trying to evade the income tax. Though with George Bush's policy, he doesn't have to do very much to evade it. If he's rich enough, he can get the various write-offs. And then he has to take out fire insurance, flood insurance. And then he has to be worried that maybe there will be some potential heirs who are trying to take over his property. Or maybe neighbors who have their eye, they want to develop his property and they're trying to find some legal pretext for taking it over. And so there's still always this worry, anxiety, concern to protect what one has gained. I call this the danger in safeguarding. And then if something should happen, some calamity, and he loses what he has struggled so hard to obtain, the fire breaks out and the house burns down. And in ancient India, they didn't have fire insurance. Or a flood comes, and floods were not unusual in ancient India. Even in Sri Lanka today, where I lived for many years, we have these, during the period of the heavy rains, these mudslides take place on the sides of the hills. And the whole, if there are houses on the hillside, all of them will collapse and be swept down, and people lose the houses which they've lived in for their whole lives, which they've built up with so much trouble, with so much difficulty. So this is the suffering in loss. So now he cries, what I had, I no longer possess. The next one maybe should be a little familiar. Okay, because of attachment to sensual pleasures, because of sensual pleasures, kings quarrel with kings. Nowadays we don't have kings, but we have nations fighting with other nations to take over their wealth. Companies taking over other companies, absorbing them in order to enhance the profits for the stockholders. So here we have nobles fighting with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders. And even within the families there are quarrels. The son doesn't like the mother because the mother won't give him a big allowance. The mother quarrels with the son because she wants the son to live a more restrained life, not to be going out so often and enjoying himself. The father fights with the son with the father. The brothers quarrel over the inheritance of the wealth. Brother with sister with brother, friend with friend. And then they eventually, these quarrels break out and disputes, brawls, even in fights, sometimes issuing in murder. Then the next two paragraphs describe how this lust and craving for sensual pleasures leads to larger scale conflict between nations, communities, warfare, fighting, killing, torment, torture. Sometimes when one nation or community conquers another, the result is oppression, enslavement, large-scale extermination. And this is all when you look at the underlying root, the underlying cause. Even examine 19th century colonialism. What is the underlying cause? The desire for the upper classes in Europe to enjoy greater wealth, to have more luxuries and enjoyment. So they conquer the third world, convince themselves that they're undertaking the white man's burden out of sympathy for the poor, benighted Asians and Africans, helping them become civilized, channeling, funneling all of their natural resources to their own countries, and leaving them impoverished. And now we don't have formal colonialism, but now imperialism appears in a new guise. But still the same process of skimming off the wealth from the third world and bringing it into the first world. Okay, then the next case, paragraph 14, again because of sensual pleasures, men break the laws of the country. They break into houses, plunder wealth, commit a burglary, ambush highways, seduce others' wives, and then if they're not clever enough, they'll get caught. And then the kings will have many kinds of torture inflicted on them. They will have them flogged. In those days, they didn't have any such notion as benign punishment. For when the king grabbed hold of a lawbreaker, he could do whatever he wants. And they were convinced that the only way, or many kings were convinced the only way to keep the country under control, to govern the country effectively, is to make sure that people are too frightened to break the laws. In order to frighten the people, then you had to really torture and torment lawbreakers. And so kings would have them flogged with whips, beaten with cane, beaten with clubs, have their hands cut off, feet cut off, hands and feet cut off, hands have their ears cut off, noses cut off, ears and noses cut off, and then subject them to a variety of tortures out of concern for your own feelings. I don't want to explain, but to relate to you how the commentary explains these tortures. Let's just say that if you were living at this time, you would not want to undergo any of them. Sometimes they would have them thrown. They would have hungry dogs, large, vicious dogs, and they would throw the criminal to the dogs and let the dogs do with them as they wish. Have them impaled alive on stakes, have their heads cut off with swords. Okay, so these, in this list of dangers arising from sensual pleasures, from 1 to 6, these are dangers which are said to be sandittiko, which means that they are visible here and now in this present life. The next one, the last one on the list, is said to be samparayika, which means it's a danger that pertains to the next life. So because, again, because of sensual pleasures, out of a desire for sensual pleasures, people indulge in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. And having done so on the dissolution of the body after death, they are reborn in state in the plains of misery, in the bad destinations and perdition, even in hell. So the text says, now this is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures, a mass of suffering in the life to come. Whereas the previous paragraph said, a mass of suffering here and now. But again, this is a mass of suffering based upon the desire for sensual pleasures. Okay, so now with this, the Buddha has finished enumerating the dangers or drawbacks in the case of sensual pleasures. And now he says, and what, monks, is the escape or the outlet, the release in the case of sensual pleasures? It is the removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for sensual pleasures. This is the escape in the case of sensual pleasures. That is the way to get liberated or freed from these dangers tied up with sensual pleasures, is to remove the desire and lust which keeps one tied or shackled to them, to abandon that desire and lust. The two Pali words used here really are interesting. Yeah, the word that's rendered removal is actually the word vinaya, which is a word which is used also to signify the code of Buddhist monastic discipline. So the monastic discipline is called Vinaya because it is the way to remove faults of bodily and verbal action. But the deeper and higher meaning of Vinaya in the Buddha's teaching is the process for removing the faults of the mind, for removing the afflictions or defilements from the mind. Okay, so now we have surveyed these three perspectives from which sensual pleasures are to be viewed: gratification, danger, and escape or release. And the commentaries make, actually this goes even further back than the commentaries to some very ancient expository texts. They make a very interesting correlation between these three perspectives and the Four Noble Truths. Of course, they say that all the Buddha's teachings can in some way be incorporated into the Four Noble Truths. So when the Buddha speaks about the gratification or enjoyment, asada, this points to the noble truth of the origin or cause of suffering. Because what is the cause of suffering? What is the second noble truth? The cause of suffering? Craving. And craving arises directed to enjoyment. The enjoyment of, on the one hand, one kind sensual pleasures, also the pleasure of the body, the pleasures of feeling. Then the danger enumerates various types of suffering that arise as a consequence of that craving. And so the danger is a way of underscoring which noble truth. What noble truth is? The first, it's the noble truth of suffering. And then the escape or release from the suffering is ultimately its nirvana, the third noble truth. And that is to be achieved by removing and abandoning the causes of one's bondage. And that is to be done by practicing the path. So the third perspective includes the third and fourth noble truths. Okay, then in paragraph 17, the Buddha makes another important comment, what I call a stipulation. He says, those recluses and Brahmins, in other words, those spiritual teachers who do not understand as it really is the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape in the case of sensual pleasures. Let me just rephrase. It is impossible, I'm paraphrasing. The Buddha says it is impossible for those spiritual teachers who do not understand as it really is the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the sensual pleasures to either themselves fully understand sensual pleasures or guide others towards a full understanding of sensual pleasures. In other words, he's saying that those, the wanderers of other sects, who thought that they understand these things, do not really understand them. And they cannot even guide others to a correct understanding. It is only when one truly understands the enjoyment or gratification in sense pleasures as gratification, one really has to understand that there is pleasure and enjoyment in the senses. But one also has to see that there is danger in this enjoyment, shortcomings or pitfalls in it, and an escape from it. It is in this way that one can fully understand sensual pleasures as such and guide others towards a full understanding of sensual pleasures. Maybe I will stop at this point, and then next week, I think I can finish the sutta next week, and then maybe go on to the next sutta next week. I think it might take me, actually, well, maybe in 20 minutes I could finish this. Would that be too... Do you think I should go on? Or? Okay, then we'll try to finish. Okay, the next category or point of attachment to be examined is the attachment to material form. And here, since the Buddha is speaking to to monks, he takes as an example of the gratification in the case of material form, a girl of noble class, Brahmin class, or householder stock. They choose them young in those days, 15 or 16 years old, not too tall, not too short, not too thin, not too fat, not too dark, not too fair, so that her beauty and loveliness is at its height. And then the pleasure and joy that arise, I guess, in a man who is viewing that beauty and loveliness, that is the gratification in the case of material form. If the Buddha was speaking to nuns, he might take the case of a a young man, 30 or 40 years old, a young man, 57 or 58 years old. But there's a little problem I see in this example, I have to say, that though this is exposing the danger in material form, bodily form, I find it a little difficult now to distinguish here where the Buddha is treating of bodily form and treating sensual pleasures. Because really what gives the pleasure and joy in dependence on the beauty of this young girl is the sensual pleasure of looking at her. It would seem to me, I don't want to seem bold and audacious, but that the text, I don't want to say the Buddha, but the text should have taken as the example of to expose the danger in bodily form a person who might be physically at the height of his or her own strength and beauty. A person who is, say, not 57, 58, but, okay, 17, 18 years old, strong, healthy, full of vitality and life, full of power and ability, and then show how that person's own body decays, grows old and decays. Then it would seem to be a category more easily distinguishable from sensual pleasures. Doesn't that seem to be the case? Oh, really? I should have checked your... In fact, I meant to do that, but I didn't have time. Yeah, that's actually more... That would be a very good point. And that way I would say the Chinese Agama would be... Yeah. I should have checked the Venerable Analios. I meant to do that, but then it escaped my mind. But that makes better sense for the comparison. And in fact, there are other suttas in which the Buddha shows the danger in bodily form in relation to a person's own body. But anyway, we continue with the example here. Okay, so you take this case of the beautiful girl, then when you look at her 15, 16... Everyone wants to sing, I shall love you forever, even though the sun may be extinguished, the stars may fall from the sky, but my love for you will never vanish. But then you're singing, your love will be eternal, but now... You get a glimpse of her, maybe some magician comes and says, "Will you like to see that lovely young girl 50 years from now? Oh, I'm sure she'll be just as beautiful. But I'll show you how you see her 65 years old, now 70, 80 years old, walking with a, leaning on a stick, doubled up, teeth broken, gray hair, or maybe even going bald, the skin all wrinkled, the limbs all blotchy. So now her beauty and loveliness has vanished. So this is the danger, and the one danger in the case of form. That's the danger of old age. Then you see the same woman, now she's afflicted, suffering, gravely ill, lying on the ground, lying in her own urine and excrement. Others have to lift her up. Others have to put her in bed. Again, where is that eternal love gone? Then you're singing, even beyond the grave, I shall love you. But now they bring the woman as a corpse in front of you. Well, you see her lying on the charnel ground, 1, 2, 3 days dead. Then see her in various stages of physical decay, till there's nothing but a heap of rotting and crumbling bones. So, where is the love song gone? Okay, so this is a danger in the case of bodily form, material form. And what is the escape in the case of material form? It is the removal of desire and lust, the abandoning of desire and lust for material form. That is the escape. Okay, then 31 makes the same, what I call the same stipulation that was made earlier regarding sensual pleasures. That is, in order to fully understand material form, one must be able, and to guide others to a full understanding, One has to be able to understand the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape. Okay, now we come to the third category, and this is the subtlest domain of clinging and attachment, the domain of feeling. Because there are various spiritual practitioners who recognize quite clearly the shortcomings and sensual pleasures, the shortcomings and dangers bound up with bodily existence. And they seek some type of liberation in an exalted type of feeling, some ecstatic or very tranquil and sublime meditative state. And they undertake meditations, enter into deep stages of samadhi or absorption, where the sense of the diversity of the outer world vanishes, even the sense of having a body vanishes, and one merges into some deep source of bliss and light within oneself, and one thinks that one has discovered the eternal, the spiritual reality. And one attaches to that experience and relishes it and enjoys it. And what one is actually attached to and is enjoying is the blissful or the tranquil feeling associated with that state. So now the Buddha will expound this in terms of what he calls the four jhanas or meditative absorptions. I'm not going to analyze them here. I'll do that when we come to the Buddha's explanation of the path. But here the Buddha just uses the stock formulas. Okay, so what is the gratification in the case of feelings? Here, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, a monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, which has applied in sustained thought, and with rapture and pleasure born from this seclusion. This is a rapture and pleasure free from sensuality. Now on this occasion, this monk is not doing anything that leads to his own affliction or to the affliction of others or the affliction of both. He's feeling, experiencing only this very sublime and blissful feeling. And so this is one case of the gratification of feelings. Then the monk goes further in his meditation, enters the second jhana, in which thought, applied and sustained thought, fall away, and there's an even more refined rapture and bliss, rapture and pleasure. Then he enters the third jhana, in which rapture falls away, and there's a very exalted bliss and pleasure. Then in the fourth jhana, even that very blissful feeling falls away, and there's a feeling of sublime equanimity. And this is the most refined, the purest, most delightful feeling that one can experience. This equanimous, tranquil, peaceful feeling in the fourth jhana. So that is, the Buddha says, that is the highest gratification in the case of feelings. But, the Buddha says, even these feelings in these sublime meditative absorptions, even these feelings are not immune from shortcomings, from faults, from defects. And what is the defect? Not that they are gross and leading to states of misery, but the defect is that those feelings are impermanent. Not that they are actually suffering, but they are in some way unsatisfactory, not able to give true, lasting security from suffering. And they are subject to change, to deterioration. And so when one recognizes the impermanence of even these very blissful and sublime feelings, then one's attachment falls away. And that is precisely the escape from them, that is the removal of desire and lust for the pleasant, blissful, or tranquil feelings of the absorption. And then the Buddha makes the same stipulation: in order to fully understand feelings, to guide others to a full understanding of feelings, one must know and understand as it actually is, the gratification as such, the danger as such, and the escape as such, in the case of feelings. Okay, and that is the discourse by the Blessed One. And the monks were satisfied and delighted in his words. Okay, that took me only 15 minutes to finish. If there's any questions, any comments, please.
I'm curious about this word
master.
Yeah. I read all the time.
Yeah.
I can understand joy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I actually have to say, I'm not so happy with the word rapture. But the Pali word is piti, piti.
Sanskrit,
piti. And I would have preferred to use joy for rapture, for piti, except that there's another word, somanasa, which I render as joy. And so I had to find another word for piti. Venerable Nyanamoli, in his original draft translation, he had used happiness for piti. And then for sukha, he used pleasure. But I prefer to use happiness for sukha. So we just, in English, we just have a shortage of words for happy states of mind.
Maybe that says something about it.
Yeah, actually, in Pali, there's many more words for happy states of mind. Rati, Rama, Nandi, Nandana. So piti comes... There are actually different types of piti. Some are connected with meditation, others are connected with ordinary experience. Even there's a sensual piti. So it's a little different from happiness. Happiness, sukha, is considered a feeling, whereas piti is considered a mental formation. But it's a kind of a joyful state of mind, let's say, which can begin in common experience as just a kind of excitement, a joyous excitement, say, when one gets something that one has wanted, when one hears some good news. The pleasure one experiences in getting the good news, that's the feeling of pleasure. But the joyous excitement, that is the piti. But then in meditation, in concentration, it becomes much more refined till it becomes a kind of bubbling exhilaration of mind as the mind gets collected, focused, concentrated, till it becomes experienced almost like a sense of buoyancy in the body, as though the body almost is rising up. And they even say that some meditators who become very successful in these preliminary meditative states are able to suffuse the whole body with this piti to the extent that the body itself can rise up physically and float through the air. And sometimes the piti is experienced as ecstatic waves of ecstasy, buoyancy, exhilaration, but it's considered a relatively coarse state. So to advance to the higher dhyanas or absorptions, even this piti has to be refined more and more till in the third jhana it drops away and there remains only the pleasant feeling or bliss without this joy or rapture. Any further questions? No further questions? Okay. Now those boxes of tapes outside, were those to be? Anybody can take those? Those are my 10 tapes?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a box with tapes outside the door, sets of 10 tapes. Those are tapes I made in 1981 in the basement of the Washington Buddhist Vihara using a relatively poor quality tape recorder. Just it was a tape recorder within one of these radio, Panasonic radio sets. But anybody who wishes, they're for free distribution, can take a set. Okay, so we close by reciting the verses for sharing the merit. Does everybody have this? Or otherwise I just recite and you just follow along.
Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.